Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Described by Herodotus as the great gift of the Nile, the land of Egypt has captivated foreign imaginations for thousands of years. Situated on the vast Mediterranean Sea, this ancient paradise of wonder built its own unique world on the shores of its great river, and developed a culture wholly based on its presence. The society that emerged has been touted as one of the most sophisticated of the ancient world, and still draws intense examination to this day. On this episode, we discuss the ancient Egyptians. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the lasting legacies they leave behind that help shape our modern world. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer. Find out about news and events on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and of course, visit your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we're going to begin a very detailed discussion of one of the most fascinating and important topics we've ever covered here in Wartime, and it's the birth of the area we know as Ancient Egypt. Now, Ancient Egypt is a place that has one time or another captivated the minds of everyone who had ever heard of its existence. It's viewed as an alien world for some, but there's something very eerily familiar about it for others. It's a fascinating topic. The great emperors of Rome, the great kings of Europe, all of them have at one time or another looked back to the Nile, looked back to the ancient Egyptian world, and looked at it in wonder. When we think of ancient Egypt, I think the image that always comes to mind, and this is true of nearly everyone who's ever seen Egypt, who's ever heard the stories of Egypt, the image that comes to mind, without a doubt, has to be the Great Pyramids of Giza. It's just something that goes hand in hand with the visual element of Egypt itself. The pyramids are enormous until the construction of the Eiffel Tower. The Great Pyramids of Giza were the tallest buildings on Earth. Amazing. When you consider that the very first pyramid ever built, which is something we'll talk about today, was 1,000 years old before the story of Moses even came to be. That's a powerful statement. I mean, this was a culture and this was a civilization that was ancient before the ancient world even existed. It's really an overwhelming and powerful idea. So Egypt is a mysterious place. Egypt draws you in. And I can say that as someone who was drawn in myself. And to cover it in one episode is really just not possible. This will be the beginning of a few episodes from a few different angles on how the Egyptian world develops. It's a very confusing place. It's a very complicated place. It's an enormously different place. So it's why in this episode we're really going to lay the limestone foundation, so to speak, of who these people are, how they see the world, why they exist, and why the way they live would not be possible unless they had different various geographic blessings, which we'll discuss. If you have listened to Episode 1 and Episode 2 of Season 2 of Wartime, you'll understand just how important something like geography is, particularly to the Mesopotamians. The Mesopotamians built their culture based on the irregular flooding of two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in modern Iraq. It made their way of life possible. But the flooding of those rivers was highly irregular. And therefore, if you were in the way when the rivers flooded, it was a catastrophic event. But if you were lucky enough to be in the area when the rivers began to recede, you would find that planting food, living in an agricultural society, supporting a civilization was not only possible, but heavily practiced and highly lucrative. So keep that in mind as we talk about the Egyptian world. Because I find in the ancient world especially, when you can compare and can contrast, you begin to see new levels and new sides of stories you think you have pretty well covered before, and sometimes find parallels and similarities that you've never thought of otherwise. So we'll begin with where Egypt is. In the time of the Greeks, and this is talking about 3,000 years after the beginnings of ancient Egypt, perhaps the man considered to be the very first historian in world history, a man named Herodotus, described Egypt as, very simply, the gift of the Nile. Now think about that statement. The Greeks were utterly fascinated by Egypt. It was a land of mystery. It was a land of intense history. It was clearly a place that determined in a lot of ways who the Greeks were early on, just as it does for us. It's a key part in the development of Western civilization. And the best thing that Herodotus could come up with, the most important thing that Herodotus could come up with, is that Egypt was the gift of the Nile. Now that's a powerful statement. So there must be a lot to it, and I'd like to spend the first part of this episode really going through what he means by that. The Nile River, without a doubt, always has been, and always will be, the lifeline of the Egyptian world, so much so that it could not exist without it. That's a powerful statement. We've already talked about the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, how important they are to the Mesopotamian world. But that idea, that notion of dependence on a body of water or river valley, is magnified greatly by the Nile. And we'll talk about why. The unique characteristics of the Nile River make the Egyptian people not only completely reliant on the river, but also a sense that controlling the river, understanding the river, predicting the river, gives the Egyptian people a very real sense that they have a relationship with the river. It's not like Mesopotamia, where you fear the rivers, but the Nile River is a river that the Egyptian people, because of the understanding of how it operates, really in their core is part of who they are. The Nile River flows through the veins of every Egyptian for the last 5,000 years. That's certainly easy to say. So what are these unique characteristics? Well, let's put it this way. Picture Egypt on a map. Without the Nile River, Egypt would be utterly and wholly uninhabitable, save for the areas closest to the Mediterranean Sea. Even with the Nile River, imagine this. Only about 5% of the Egyptian landmass, that's with the Nile River, only about 5% of the Egyptian landmass is habitable. And that's still today in our modern world with its advanced technology. There are a few oases where you could live. There, of course, is the land touching the sea, as you'll see in a lot of parts of North Africa. But the Nile River changes the game completely for the Egyptians. The Nile River is an enormous feature of the land. It's over 4,000 miles long. But there are some unique characteristics about it that the Egyptians early on learned to harness, and I think more importantly live with, that allow them to be successful. The Nile River, just like the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in Mesopotamia, will flood. But unlike the Mesopotamian River Valley, the Nile River floods like clockwork. Imagine, if you were an Egyptian farmer, if you're a person hoping to benefit from an agricultural society, and you know almost to the day when the river will flood every year. Now that happens because of the regularity of a lot of the other landforms around it, particularly coming from farther south in Africa. But the river will flood on a steady, regular basis. You know when it's going to happen. You know when it's going to emerge. So you know when to get out of the way, and you know when you can return. You know exactly how much you can plant, and you know exactly how much you can charge for whatever it is you grow. Again, I equate this to the paycheck metaphor. When you go to sleep knowing you're getting check at the end of the week, you feel better about yourself. You sleep soundly. You know you're going to feed your family. You know you're going to pay your bills and your debts. Now, when you don't have that paycheck coming, when you aren't sure when that next bit of wealth is coming your way, it makes for a very difficult and uncertain life. And this is true of everyone. All of us have been there. The Egyptians, we can say, don't have that uncertainty, not the way the Mesopotamians do. The Mesopotamians never know when their river will flood. The Egyptians know exactly when it will happen. Now, that sounds like a nice idea, but what we can say is this notion affects the Egyptians down to a core level of who they are. And as we move more and talk about who the Egyptians are and how they live, we'll see exactly how that operates. Flooding is regular and reliable. This is a recipe for civilization to develop very early. So never take the Mesopotamians out of your mind in this regard. How difficult their life is, filled with war, filled with competition. All because the flooding of their rivers are irregular. Is it really that simple? It might be. That's the beauty of history. Now, what 5% of the Egyptian landscape is actually inhabitable? Well, what you'll see is if you follow the Nile River, which flows south to north to the Mediterranean Sea, it's a relatively straight shot. The Nile River is not an especially winding river. It does have some bends in it, but nothing we would consider to be a drastic or extreme one. And if you follow that river northward, what you'll find over and over again are small clusters of villages and cities all along the riverbanks. You don't really see any cities or any notions of civilizations to the east or west in the desert. It's too hot. It's too desolate. This is the Sahara Desert we're dealing with here. But if you can hug the banks of that river, you can take advantage of the lush, green soil and farmland that it encompasses. And all of that comes from the knowledge that that river will flood, and you know exactly when it will happen. Because of this, and you can see it in their religion. Again, as a social and cultural historian, I tend to look there first because it tells you more about the people, I think, than just battles and leaders. You'll see that the Egyptians will worship the Nile River on an almost religious level. It's not just something they live near. It's not just something they benefit from, but it's considered to be part of who they are. And it's very hard for us to understand exactly what that means. But it's a physical landform that really defines the people as we know it. Because the river floods frequently, because there is that safety, there is that comfort in knowing of when it's going to happen, we tend to see warfare as a very rare and uncommon event early on in Egyptian history. Compare that to Mesopotamia, when warfare really was a way of life to the point that it almost brought down their civilization. In the Egyptian world, you see very little fighting amongst the Egyptians themselves early on. The reason is, well, what brings about war? Competition brings about war. You're competing over land. You're competing over resources. You're competing in times, especially when maybe Mother Nature's not playing the game the way you'd like. In Mesopotamia, rivers flood very infrequently. You don't know when that next great harvest is going to come. You have to take whatever you can find. And when you try to take someone else's property, you go to war. In the Egyptians, they always have exactly what they're looking for. The system works for them. So warfare is something that's a great casualty of a very comfortable and very predictable river valley. The Nile River is everything to the Egyptians. And as Herodotus said, the Egyptians are the gift of the Nile. So we see where he's coming from there, and kudos to him for being so observant and seeing the importance of the river valley to those people. But there's more to it than just that. And can we trace it all back to the Nile River and its flooding? I mean, that seems to be a wholly geomorphological event. Is it little to what we'll call deterministic to say a whole people's outlook in the world is built by that? I don't think so. But we'll say it's the driving force behind it. There's a few other elements we can talk about with the Egyptian world, and again, we're just trying to give a sense of who they are before we get into the great histories of these people, the great achievements of these people. None of those can be well understood without knowing who they are, because they are a very different people than we are, and they have a very different outlook on the world than we do. But when we look at Egyptian art, And when we look at Egyptian architecture, we can see a few little elements they leave behind that give us a better insight into who they are. I love using artwork as a source in this regard, because it's far too often left out of the discussion on the best historical sources. Because the artist is always, yes, completing something that reveals to us something about them, but in a much larger sense, and the artist probably isn't aware that they're doing this. It also tells us a great deal about their time period. They inject themselves into everything they do. Writers do it, authors do it, podcast hosts do it. You're always giving up a little bit of information about the time period in which you live, and you're really doing it in a way you don't even realize. But when we look at Egyptian art, we can see that. What we can say is, change is very undesirable in the Egyptian world. Change is something they don't want. Change is something they feel they don't need. They have a system that works for them, and therefore their art tends to be very upbeat. Their art tends to be very optimistic in the way it's designed. Why is it so upbeat, and why is it so optimistic? Well, again, their river's going to flood, and they know exactly when it's going to happen. And the wheels, so to speak, will keep turning, and the ball will keep bouncing. Their culture, their society, is fully driven by the comfort, security, and prosperity that the Nile River Valley brings. Compare Egyptian artwork to the artwork of the Mesopotamian world, and boy, you're talking about night and day. Egyptian artwork, again, is very positive. It's generally, we would say, very upbeat. Mesopotamian artwork tends to be very dark. Mesopotamian artwork tends to be very pessimistic in that regard. Very different. And we know Mesopotamia is a place of near constant change. Change, again, something you're not going to find very easily in Egypt. So, not to belabor the point of the river, but I really want you to have a sense of exactly what we're talking about here. Rivers are important. And it's no wonder that the first two major civilizations in the history of the Western world develop around places that have a unique and functional relationship with a river and a river valley. So it's important we deal with that when we talk about the Egyptians. But the Egyptian people, with this positive outlook, with this inward-looking society, will develop unique features that won't really emerge anywhere else on the planet. And it really comes from their view of the world. When we talk about how they govern themselves, leadership amongst the people, we say they have a very sedentary lifestyle. That is, they live where they live, and they do it for generations upon generations, and they don't move, and they don't leave. Again, they have a good thing where they are. They're never going to take off. They're going to stay where they need to be. And because of that lifestyle, we see develop a system that's completely centered around remaining in one place and doing what works. Again, it's a sedentary lifestyle. What emerges is a position of power that the Egyptians describe as the Great House. And the word they use is Pharaoh. Now, Egypt will become an empire, and we'll talk about how it happens. But they'll never have what we think of as an emperor. It just won't be there. The title they'll use is Pharaoh. And Pharaoh is much, much more than just a political identification. We've probably all heard that word before. And again, the Egyptian translation would be Great House. But the Pharaoh is not just a politician. Although he does have to be in that regard, and as we'll see, she has to be as well. But the Pharaoh is literally believed to be a living God. Not just a representative of God, not just a prophet that the gods speak to, but a living God, a God on earth. And he's represented and he's worshipped as such. That is a powerful statement that we haven't seen anywhere else in the world yet. And unfortunately, politicians in the future will run with that very notion as well. Divine kingship, we could think of it as. He is a living God. In Mesopotamia, we never saw that. We saw leaders believing they were representatives of the gods. We saw leaders pretending to be prophets of the god, priests of the gods. But we've never seen a person who passed himself off as a living, breathing God on earth. And that's the deal that the Pharaoh had. And that's because the Egyptian people were so content with the system as it worked. They'd do anything to keep that system running. So we could imagine things that the Pharaoh may say. You must please the Pharaoh, because if you don't, the Pharaoh will not allow the rivers to flood. The Pharaoh will keep the fresh and necessary waters away from the shores, away from the Egyptians that need it so bad. There are some cases of the Pharaoh holding the Egyptian people hostage, keeping the waters away from them. Now, of course, the Pharaoh had nothing to do with the flooding of the Nile River. But the people believed if you keep the Pharaoh happy, the rivers will continue to flood. It's an equation they did not want to dabble with, right? Happy Pharaoh, happy Egyptians. That's the idea. So it's a fascinating topic. And it's one that, again, is worth a lot of discussion. So I'm glad we could spend so much time on it. But again, we're getting to the culture of the Egyptians. Who are these people? Where are they from? And since we talked about the Mesopotamians, how much did they really have in common with them? Well, a lot of students, when they come into my class, their only experience with history is either a high school class or a middle school class. They really aren't sure what historians do. They really aren't sure how we actively engage in the field. And I like this topic we're moving to next because it really allows us to illustrate exactly what historians argue about. Historians do not argue about the facts. They are what they are. The Egyptians build the pyramids, right? That's not much fun. If you want to argue about facts, you know, play Trivial Pursuit with your uncle or something over the holidays. What we do is look at the material. And we begin to pull it apart, and we begin to extrapolate new meaning from it. We search for answers that aren't necessarily a yes or a no. If you want the smoking gun, if you want the positive or affirmative, if that's going to help you sleep better at night, being a historian may not be for you. But here's a topic in the Egyptian world where we see a lot of debate over the earliest people who are the Egyptians. The debate is this, and a lot of people tend to forget this, in the way they talk about it, even historians in the field. The Egyptian world is on the continent of Africa. Now, that seems like a no-brainer, but really think what goes into that. When we talk about the Egyptians, we tend to think of them as a non-African people. We can at times group them into the larger Near East, the larger Mediterranean world. We group them in with people like the Mesopotamians at times. Why? Because in the future they'll have a very intense conversation, so to speak, of trade and economics and what not only them, but also the Greeks and also the Romans. But it's an undeniable fact that Egypt is in Africa. So the question is, do we consider the Egyptians Africans themselves? Well, if we're going to do that, we have to look at some of the other peoples developing the African continent around them. And what we see is some striking similarities. And this is what leads to debates really in the field as we go through. And it really sort of goes like this, a little bit of the history of history for you. Before World War II, Egypt was viewed as very much its own thing. And if it wasn't, it was grouped into the larger ancient world. But after World War II, after new opportunities emerged, not only through people going to college who never were able to get an education before, bringing new opinions to the forefront, people seeing parts of the world they were never able to see before, new discoveries made, there was a very real strand of thought that much of the Egyptian culture was very, very similar to much of the African peoples that surrounded them on the continent. There was clearly a cultural exchange there, and some began to say, well, the ancient Egyptians were probably more African than Near Eastern, and the world, at least academically, began to divide itself into two camps. Those who believed the Egyptians were more like their neighbors to the east in the ancient world, and those who said the Egyptians were more like their neighbors to the west and south in the African world. When you begin to look at the material, and this stance is not generally a very fun stance, but I think it's the most appropriate one, we begin to see that, you know, the Egyptians are probably a little bit of both. And I don't think that's necessarily a problem, and anything else might be splitting hairs. Here's what we can say. The notion that a leader, a political figure like the Pharaoh, has direct control not only over the people, but over the agriculture, over the land, and over something like flooding, we can say the notion that the Pharaoh controls plentiful agriculture, that's generally an Egyptian idea, but that is without doubt, that is without question, That is an African ideal. That comes from many different African societies that develop around the Egyptians at the same time. That is not a Near Eastern ideal. That is not a Mesopotamian ideal. That is an African ideal. What takes us in the other direction? Well, by 3400 BCE, the Egyptians are using bronze weapons, just like the Mesopotamians. Of course, bronze being a combination of two naturally occurring minerals, copper at about 90%, and to another degree, about 10% tin. You can't mine bronze out of the ground. You create it. That was something that takes trial and error, and we know that's something we first see in Mesopotamia. Did the Egyptians discover it on their own? Well, odds are, through trade, they first found the benefits of metalwork and made it themselves afterwards. So it's an interesting idea. Are the Egyptians more African or more Near Eastern? I would say the truth is probably somewhat moderate. But what you see from this is, and if you visit Egypt today, you can still see this. The Egyptian people do not consider themselves to be part of this or part of that. The Egyptians consider themselves to be their own unique peoples, even to this day. A lot of people try to pigeonhole the Egyptians. Are you this? Are you that? Are you part of this or part of that? And the Egyptians will tell you, first and foremost, they are Egyptian. They have their own history. They have their own background. They are part of larger communities like all of us are. But they're Egyptian above all else. So I think that should be one of the most important guiding principles we deal with as we go through this. Because we don't want to lose sight of just how big they are. I mean, Egyptian history has its own field, Egyptology, because it's just so big and just so important. So let's start to get into a little bit of the history of early Egypt. We'll talk about some of their major achievements before we really get into the individuals and the events that really shape its history. But here's what we can say. By about 5000 BCE, that's 7,000 years before the time you're listening to this podcast, we begin to see agriculture arrive in the Nile River Valley. Now, why there? That's very early, 5,000 BCE. We see not only agriculture, but sedentary life. It's all about that river. It does not take human beings very long to figure out the benefit of that, especially in the harsh Sahara Desert. So by 4000 BCE, about 6000 years before this podcast, you begin to see the first true villages and towns emerging. Now, this is not the Egypt that we know yet. This is not an Egypt of pyramids. This is not an Egypt of pharaohs. This is not an Egypt of advanced civilization. But it is an Egypt that's beginning to consider itself a unique group of people. And much like the Mesopotamians, despite common language and common tradition, they view themselves as very different. We like to say that about this point, Egypt has now divided itself into two distinct kingdoms. There is Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. Now here's the confusing thing. Upper Egypt is in the south. Lower Egypt is in the north. If you're ever confused by this, just remember it's completely flipped to our sensibilities. Upper Egypt is in the south, and the kingdom of Lower Egypt is in the north. There is a distinct and special reason for that, and it goes back to, of all things, the river itself. Remember, the Nile River flows south to north. So if you're in the south, the river is flowing away from you. It's flowing toward the Mediterranean Sea in the north. So for you, if you follow downriver, you're moving in a northward direction. That's all it is. The river flows the opposite way, so to them, Upper Egypt is in the south, Lower Egypt is in the north. We cannot take for granted how important it is in the modern world that we have a spatial understanding of our world. We have Google Earth. We have maps. If I would ask you to identify a country by its shape, you could probably do it, because we have the ability to view our world from the top down, from a bird's eye view. These are people that did not have that opportunity. So for them, north, south, east, and west, although it's something they did to a degree grasp, they didn't have the spatial understanding that would make Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt, being in the south and the north respectively, that difficult of a concept. Never underestimate that. It's a very recent phenomenon to be able to have a spatial understanding of our world. But that's what the Egyptians will see. Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. In the north and the south. And they're all completely dependent on the Nile River, so they all hug that Nile River. These are different people. They have similar customs, but politically they are separate. So how do they become one? Because the Egyptian Empire as we know it, the Egyptian civilization as we know it, is not possible without unification. Unification will come, by our best guesses, between the years 3100 and 3050 BCE. We aren't certain, but those dates sound very specific for not being certain. But we do have a sense from the historical record of who the king who instituted this new change, who propelled this new change forward, was. The Greeks will call him and refer to him as Menes, which is a Greek name, not an Egyptian name, Menes. But when we look at the record, when we look at the details, archaeologists, historians, and Egyptologists will pretty much universally agree this is probably the pharaoh we know to be named Narmer. What was the unification like, and who was this person? Well, we don't have a lot of information on the unification of Egypt, but here's what we do know. Menes, or Narmer, was the king of Upper Egypt. He took over Lower Egypt in what was probably a hostile conquest, and by doing so, he brought forth what we consider to be the birth of the unified Egyptian world. But the information is really sparse, and it really does stop very quickly, and it's one of the challenges of archaeology. One of the difficulties of archaeology is that we really only know, and we really only have access to, what we pull out of the ground, what we dig up. As historians, we interpret sources, and again, I'm not an archaeologist, I'm a historian, but as archaeologists, you're really limited by what you have found so far. Now, you can extrapolate some meaning, but you're really always handcuffed by the fact that you'll never find everything. But you're also very much propelled into the future by the fact that you can find anything at any given time that could change the way we think of the past. Maybe the greatest archaeological discovery in history is still buried somewhere in the desert. Who knows? It's what keeps you going. But it's one of the realities is that we'll never know really who Narmer or Menes really was in the fullest extent. We don't have his journals. We don't have firsthand accounts of him for the most part. You have a very limited bit of information. But he is the one that unifies the upper and lower kingdom. Some will call the first pharaoh in Egyptian history. Now, we can learn a lot about Menes or Narmer based on the images we find. And a lot of these images are on small artifacts. But what we do know is that the king of Upper Egypt and the king of Lower Egypt, again, with a similar language and a similar society and a similar culture, only political divisions, represent themselves physically in different ways. And they represent themselves by wearing two different varieties of headdress. Now, there's other differences. But this shows you the insight of Menes or Narmer, whatever you want to refer to him as. As the king of Upper Egypt, he wears a very specific headpiece. It's white, it's large, it's pointed. The king of Lower Egypt wears a very different headpiece. It's orange, it's much more angular. The important thing is this. Whenever Narmer takes over, he combines both headpieces into one. He devises a new headdress that clearly belongs to the king of Upper Egypt, and clearly has elements belonging to the king of Lower Egypt. So we don't want to say this is assimilation, but it does give a very physical display that I am not only your new king, but I'm the king of something completely different, and we'll never go back to what we had before. Now, it will go from there. Some historians may believe that maybe Menes or Narmer never existed. They think maybe that name is a euphemism, is a representation of many early kings. Because it's unusual for unification to occur in one fell swoop in most political circumstances. But again, these are the challenges of archaeology that we see. Most will say that Menes or Narmer is the first pharaoh. And with being pharaoh, with having such a big responsibility, changes have to be made. And one of the constants we see throughout early Egyptian history is the fact that the pharaoh has what we would consider to be a glorious appearance. And this is something we didn't typically see in other parts of the world at this time. The pharaoh is entirely decked out in jewels and gold and fine gems and rubies. You want him to appear as though he's kind of a big deal, I guess we could say. And he has a glorious appearance. And later kings will adopt this. Because if this person is a living god, if this person is far and beyond, above anything or anyone you've ever seen before, you want your people to see you and be in reverence. And the notion of a glorious appearance, the notion of this over-the-top look, is something that will really be grasped onto by the pharaohs. And later kings will do it all the time. They use their outward physical appearance and displays of wealth to perpetuate the idea of who they are and who they represent. So that's what we can see. Now let's talk a little bit about Egyptian religion and the Egyptian afterlife. And again, this takes us back to a degree to the Nile River, but also it allows us to compare and contrast with the Mesopotamians. Remember we talked about the Mesopotamian view of the afterlife, very different than the modern Judeo-Christian Islamic view of the afterlife. In the Judeo-Christian Islamic view of the afterlife today, heaven, if you want to use that word, the great beyond, is always viewed as a reward for leading a good life. If you're a good person, you go to heaven, you walk through the pearly gates. If you're a bad person, you burn in the fiery torments of hell for an eternity. So there is a risk and reward element there. That's something that really has developed fairly recently, and in the ancient world was typically unheard of, that notion of a choice. Remember, the Mesopotamian afterlife, the Sumerian afterlife, was a terrible, shadowy existence. There was no heaven. There was no hell. You went to a place that wasn't entirely comfortable for anyone, and the only way your soul could remain here on Earth was to, quote, torment the living. That's a tough existence, right? We talked about that in Episode 1 and Episode 2 of Season 2 of Wartime. But the Egyptians will come to the table with a completely different view of what the afterlife and what the great beyond looks like. To them, the afterlife was a very pleasant, positive experience. The notion of a hell, the notion of a place of punishment, didn't really exist for the Egyptians, at least not early on, or what we would describe as for most of Egyptian history. But the afterlife was a continuation of your pleasant life that you led on Earth. And for the most part, early on, it was one only reserved for the very wealthiest amongst them. It's for this reason that we see the Egyptians engage in a very unique practice for us so far in this series of preparing for death, almost the way that moderns prepare for an extended vacation. We'll see before the death of the very wealthy in the Egyptian world, because again, the afterlife is a pleasant experience. We'll see clear steps made to make sure that your journey to the great beyond is as comfortable as possible. It's why we begin to see tombs filled with gold and riches and personal artifacts of all kinds. It's what also made the tomb of a recently buried pharaoh, for example, a very prime target, a very cherry target for grave robbers for a lot of different reasons. But the belief of the Egyptians was that the spirit would go to the great beyond, but also be able to return to its earthly body whenever it desired, if it wanted to play with its gizmos and play with its gadgets and do whatever else. So it wasn't only about preparing the tomb for burial, but also preparing the body for burial. And of course, we're talking about mummification. Mummification was a process of preservation. And the preservation process was designed to keep the body intact as much as possible for when the disembodied spirit would return to its body and, you know, use the things it was buried with. Mummification was a long process. It's a highly advanced process, but a highly effective process. The organs would be removed from the body. They'd be placed in jars mixed with both salt and what we would basically consider today to be baking soda. And the organs would be dried out. After that, they'd be removed from the solution or the mixture. They'd be preserved, of course, in boxes. If the organs were to stay in the human body, Egyptians discovered this very early, the organs would expand, the physical body itself would be destroyed, and the spirit could never return to it, and that's not something they were willing to stand for. So the process of mummification really comes out of that idea. But again, the afterlife is typically early on a privilege of the very wealthy. As Egyptian civilization develops, more progressive notions begin to arrive, and it becomes something for everyone. But early on, it's just for the super wealthy. Now, we mentioned already there is no heaven and there is no hell in the Egyptian world. You just have this grand, wonderful afterlife. Well, that's a very optimistic view. Where does that come from? Because remember, their neighbors, the Mesopotamians, have a very pessimistic view. Well, again, I think it comes back to something as simple but as monumental as the rivers themselves. Remember, the Mesopotamians have a very pessimistic view of the world because the rivers flood at random intervals. It makes life very uncertain. The Egyptians have a river that floods like clockwork. And this sense of positive energy, this positive worldview, permeates their society. Why should their belief in the afterlife be any different? I would argue it isn't. So a constant river, a feeling of safety and security at all times, would lead to a positive worldview and lead the Egyptians to have a positive view of what lies on the great beyond. Rivers, amazing things, not just for what they do, but how they affect their people. So there is no heaven and there is no hell. So what is the punishment? Well, here's what we'll see. When a person dies, there is, and any Egyptian could tell you this in the ancient world, a series of processes that one must go through before they can be accepted into the afterlife. And if you go through these hurdles effectively, then paradise is yours. But here's what you'll see. When you die, this is the spiritual belief, your soul, your spirit, is put on trial by what we consider to be the great 42 of the ancient world. It's a collection of peoples and spirits that judge whether or not you have led a good life. Now, once you clear that hurdle, you have to go through another series of judgments. And if you get through, you're in the clear. If you fail at any time, if you're found guilty at any time, life gets a little more hairy. That's the end of your existence. What happens next, though, is that your earthly heart, your spiritual heart, whichever one you want to interpret this as, is weighed on a scale of judgment against the feather of truth. And this is weighed for purity. Now, again, this is all a spiritual belief, but all Egyptians would have believed in this very clear process. The measurement will be done by the god Anubis. You've all seen Anubis. He's got the black dog's head. He's really portrayed in many different places. Almost in every single Egyptian tomb you find, you'll see an image of Anubis. And if you pass the test on the scale, if you weigh your heart against the feather of truth to determine your purity, then you move on to the great beyond. If at any point, though, you're found to be guilty or found to be impure or unjust, then your ride ends. Your soul, your heart, your spirit is fed to Anubis's trusty companion named Ament, and it's gobbled up. And that's the end of your existence. So there isn't really a hell, but there is just an end. Ammit is a very fascinating character. I'd encourage you to look him up, because he's sort of every Egyptian's worst fear writ large in one place. He's got the head of a crocodile. He's got the four legs of a lion, the mane of a lion. And he's got the rear of what is considered to be pretty widely the most vicious and dangerous animal in the Egyptian world, the hippopotamus. The hippopotamus is so feared, it's a hyper-aggressive, enormous animal. It's even said that Menes, or Narmer, who we talked about earlier, was actually eaten, was actually killed by a hippopotamus later in life. That's how he met his untimely end. But the Egyptians have a very clear and very specific and typically very positive view of the world. Even the fact that you can make it to a paradise, compared to the Mesopotamians who just think you're doomed to a horrible, shadowy existence no matter what, gives us a very interesting insight into these people, who they are, and how they view the world. Now, what we're going to talk about in the next series of episodes of Wartime are some of the specific achievements of the Egyptian world and just why they're so important. We could have done that earlier, but I really don't think without this base information, you could really have a good enough sense of who the Egyptians were and what they really believed in. Because once you understand how they view the world, then the rest of it will fall into place pretty easily. On the next episode, we'll discuss the Old Kingdom of Egyptian history and the great achievements that it wrought. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.